The broadcast is now starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
Good afternoon. My name is Courtney Kendall from the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, and I'd like to welcome you to today's webinar. We're excited to have you with us today, and I would like to apologize for the technical difficulties that we were having. So it looks like we're just going to go ahead and we're going to start from the beginning of the presentation. Before we get started, I just have a few items to cover. I want to mention that everybody is on listen-only mode, and this presentation will be recorded. And so you have two options for how you can hear today's webinar. In the upper right corner of your screen, there is a box that says audio mode. This will allow you to choose whether or not you want to listen to the webinar through your computer speakers or a telephone. As a rule, if you can listen to music on your computer, you should be able to hear the webinar. Select either use telephone or use mic and speakers. If you select use telephone, the box will display the telephone number and specific audio pin you should use to dial in. If you'd like to use mic and speakers, you might want to click on audio setup to test your audio. We will have a question and answer session at the end of the presentation. You can participate by submitting your questions electronically during the webinar. Please do this by going to the questions pane in the box showing on your screen. There you can type in any question that you have during the course of the webinar. And our speaker will address as many questions as time allows after the presentation. So our speaker today is David Hurlbut. David is a senior analyst with the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, and he will be discussing transmission planning in the Western Interconnection. With that, we will go ahead and get started with the presentation. So go ahead and take it away, David.
All right. Thank you, Courtney. And again, I'd like to apologize for the technical difficulties. I'll go through some of the introductory bit fairly quickly because we covered a lot of it on our last webinar. Okay, but the objectives today are really to go over transmission planning at a fairly high level, but to focus on those aspects that would affect some of the projects that you may be looking at coming across your desk. To see how they fit into the bigger picture and what sorts of analysis is done to determine whether to start. Okay, and we'll be focusing on the planning that's at the second to the second box here, NERC Reliability Organizations. That is the Western Electric Coordination Council. That's where a lot of the regional planning takes place. So we'll be focusing on the activities there. Next slide. A little bit of background. There are several federal actions that are guiding transmission planning, particularly in the West at this point, versus FERC Order 890. This required transmission providers to establish open and transparent planning processes. Before transmission had been done primarily by utility engineers looking at reliability, looking at cost, taking projects to their regulators to get approval for recovery in their rates. Today, planning is much more complicated, and it involves more participants, more stakeholders than the utilities themselves. So what FERC Order 890 does is to require providers to establish a transparent process by which all stakeholders, in addition to the utilities, will have a say in what's done. It requires transmission providers to coordinate and to assume to ensure that transmission service is provided on a non-discriminatory basis. Next slide, please. The next order was FERC Order 1000, and this took the principles of Order 890 a step further by requiring transmission providers to engage in regional transmission planning. And to particularly to coordinate regional transmission plans, taking into account transmission needed to fulfill public policy requirements. In particular, the idea was to enable cost-effective and efficient delivery of renewable resources in response to state renewable energy requirements. Prior to Order 1000, the two primary principles driving transmission planning were to minimize cost to customers and to maximize the reliability of the system, harmonizing those two goals. Additional transmission for the purposes of meeting renewable energy requirements didn't neatly fit into either of those buckets. So Order 1000 formally put public policy requirements on the planning radar with respect to new transmission. Next slide, please. In addition, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act included some money for interconnection-wide transmission planning. Now, historically, transmission has been planned at the utility level for local needs and local purposes. As the system has become more complex and more interconnected, it's been more necessary for utilities to engage in joint planning and regional planning to cover a larger footprint. What ARRA did was to provide money for interconnection-wide planning, that is, for transmission assessment and planning that would cover the entire interconnection. And in the West, that includes everything from British Columbia and Alberta down to Baja California and eastward to Colorado, Kansas, and to the Great Plains. So right now, the Western Governors and the Western Electric Coordination Council have been funded to conduct this sort of regional interconnection-wide planning. WGA is covering a lot of the policy issues, the regulatory issues that are involved in getting states to collaborate with respect to procurement and planning. WEC is doing a lot of the technical modeling and the technical planning, looking at various issues relating to reliability. Next slide. Now, generally, there are two types of transmission upgrades that are the focus of planning. One is reliability upgrades. These are improvements to the transmission system that might not necessarily increase the amount of power that would be delivered to customers, but would minimize the risk of catastrophic failure, such as a blackout. And many times this is determined either through the age of particular infrastructure, how old is a line, how old is a generator. It's also determined by load growth. If load grows in a particular geographic pattern, does that put different strains on the transmission system? Does that create congestion? Does that create reliability points that can be relieved by some specific targeted investments? The other type of upgrade is an economic upgrade. And this is done more at the larger regional level. Next slide, please. Economic upgrades focus on the delivery, the cost of delivering power to customers. It looks at whether there are upgrades that will enable more generation from a low-cost unit to be delivered to customers. It also looks at, this is where policy objectives such as renewable energy delivery come into play as well. Now, economic upgrades usually have reliability benefits as well, and these are usually incorporated into the planning for a particular economic upgrade to measure the reliability impacts. But what really defines an economic upgrade is the ability to deliver power at a lower cost than is possible on the grid as it exists today. Now, one important distinction to make is that planning is not the same as construction. WEC and transmission providers will conduct planning for various projects, various proposals, but not all of them get built, and very few of them get built for a variety of reasons. But everything that does get built has to be validated through these types of studies, either for economic studies or for reliability studies. Next slide, please. So with economic upgrades, transmission planners, transmission providers, as well as WEC at the regional level, frame a number of questions in their study of the viability and the need for a new transmission line. First, they look at how load growth will change the utilization of the existing power system. Not only the amount of growth, but where that growth takes place. It could place stress on different parts of the transmission system. And it's not exactly intuitive sometimes where that stress will take place. So this has to be modeled to see what the overall costs are. It also looks at whether there are points specific points on the system that will experience more additional cost than others when they become stressed by additional load. And then finally, with respect to the specific stress points, the specific cost points, can they be fixed? Can they be addressed with a cost-effective line upgrade or some sort of transmission expansion? So these are the general types of planning questions that WEC and transmission utilities look at with respect to economic upgrades. Next slide. Now, there are many tools that WEC uses and many tools that transmission utilities use. I'm going to focus on production cost modeling, and this is by no means the only analytical tool that they use, but it's the one that is usually the first step in sort of screening out which projects are really economically viable to take to the next level of planning. Production cost modeling is essentially an optimization model. It's a very complex piece of software that simulates all of the operating conditions on the grid. It looks at each generating point, each generator on the system. It takes into account how much it costs to run per megawatt hour. It takes into account how quickly it can ramp up or ramp down in response to changes in condition. It takes into account load and demand, not only on the system as a whole, but specifically at specific points on the grid, how much load, how much demand is being placed on the system at a given specific point. The results from production cost modeling provide the basis for looking at different types of scenarios. The types of answers and the types of output from a production cost model include the total cost of operating the system, how much fuel is used, how much natural gas, how much coal is burned to generate enough electricity to meet load on the system. The results tell you how much power is dispatched from each unit on the system. It gives you an output of total emissions on the system. It shows how much utilization and the congestion on specific lines. And it also gives you the cost of operation at specific points on the system. And if we can go to the next slide, we'll take a closer look at this. The power system is one of the few sectors that rival the federal government in the amount of acronyms that it uses in its regular vocabulary. And one acronym that you may hear in discussions with your transmission planners, project developers who come in with projects, are LMPs. LMPs are locational marginal prices, and LMP indicates the value of electricity at a given place or a given node on the electrical system. It reflects the cost to the overall system of providing one more megawatt hour of power at that location. So what production cost modeling does is to identify where the cheapest configuration of generation could be obtained, taking into account all of the line limitations that are existing on the system. And what I've shown here is a very, very simplified picture of how production cost modeling works and the LMPs that it generates. If you look at a hypothetical load center demand of 120 megawatts, and if you have two generators on the system, one that can produce power at $30 a megawatt hour, $40 per megawatt hour, but the lowest cost generator is on a line that has a line limit of 80 megawatts. What the production cost model will do is to reconfigure the dispatch from both of those generators, taking into account that 80 megawatt line limit to achieve the least cost solution that will provide sufficient power to the load center. And with the result that the average cost to this load center in this particular example is about $33.33 per megawatt hour. So this approximates the LMP at that point, which is different from the average cost or the marginal cost at either of the two generators. Next slide, please. Now, the types of answers that we get from production cost modeling allow comparison of scenarios. If one development path is taken as opposed to another, we can see how prices will change across the entire West. Sometimes in some areas they'll be more expensive and some less. Do total costs go up and down when moving from one scenario to another? Do any lines become more congested, and how much additional cost does that particular congestion create? Is there a change in the type of units that are chosen? Is there a switching taking place between coal and natural gas, for example? In this example here, you can see that there is a point of congestion on the Nevada border with California. That red dot indicates LMPs that are higher, primarily due to line congestion and the difficulty of moving power across that corridor. So these are the answers. These are the types of information that we get from production cost modeling. If we can go to the next slide. And it's very important to take into account also what production cost modeling doesn't do. There is no one model out there that will give you the entire picture of the entire generating system or the entire transmission system. A production cost model will tell you how much it costs to operate the system as it is today. What it does not do is to add transmission lines. It can show you how much it would cost to have a line that is too small, or how much congestion would imposes, but it's not going to add a transmission line to solve it. It does not retire existing generation. It does not capture capital costs, and this is an important distinction. A production cost model assumes that whatever has needed to happen in order to cover the capital cost of a particular generator has already happened. So the capital cost is already covered somehow. What the production cost model does is it takes into account the variable cost, or the marginal cost, or the total cost of, you know, that needs to go into the process to generate 1 megawatt hour of electricity. That's what it optimizes. So what this means, one important upshot of this, is that certain assumptions, particularly assumptions about fuel costs, are very important to the outcomes that come out of a production cost model. Assumptions about the price of natural gas could affect the relative benefit of a line that you may be examining. And of course, you know, this all happens at WECC, but prior to the project coming in for permitting, this is the sort of testing and modeling that has taken place to look at the need and the economic viability of that line. So we go to the next slide, please. So that's a very quick background of the types of tools that WECC uses in its regional planning. Now, right now, WECC has a 2-year study cycle. It takes plans on an annual basis, but then each cycle of study requests that comes in are evaluated, and the most viable scenarios are selected for study, and those go forward. What WECC is looking at right now is they've run a base case model, where renewables are obtained from the system as it is, using the most economic locations, and it also takes into account new lines that are under construction. So with this base case, it will then artificially stress the system through the production cost model to see what happens if you force another 6,000 megawatts of renewables in one state, in another state, or in another state. Now, this doesn't necessarily assume that 6,000 megawatts will be actually built. Another 6,000 megawatts will be built in Montana. The purpose is to see what parts of the system are stressed if this were to occur, and are there common weak points among these stress scenarios that suggest the importance of transmission improvements. So if you can go to the next slide, please. This map shows what WEC is referring to as their common case transmission assumptions. These are transmission lines that do not yet exist, but are either under construction or so far along in their permitting there's virtual certainty that they will that these lines are going to happen. And because planning takes place on a 10-year time horizon, it's important for these lines to be incorporated into the modeling process. Next slide, please. This shows quickly the distribution of renewable energy generation in WEC's base case. You can see wind is a dominant player in Wyoming, Montana, most states. In California, you see a diversity of resources. The largest amount of renewable resource development takes place in California. And we also see a lot of geothermal taking place in Nevada and Utah. Next slide, please. So the stress cases test the robustness of the transmission system to particular differences in how renewables might be deployed. And also, does it change how other generators on the system are dispatched? Does it cause curtailment or does it cause thermal resources to turn on and turn off excessively? We can go to the next slide, please. This graphically shows the stress test for Montana. It's assuming that an additional 6,000 megawatts of wind is added to the transmission system in Montana, and you can see that the effects are a much smaller reduction in the amount of generation coming from coal capacity in Montana. And you also see some reductions in combined cycle natural gas generation in California and in Colorado and to a lesser extent in Nevada. These result from the interconnection, the complex network of interrelationships on the transmission network. So the effects are not just limited to the location where the model change is taking place. If we can go to the next slide, please. Primarily wind, the reductions are in primarily coal. This slide shows the effect on transmission congestion. You see the red arrow going from Montana into Idaho. This is the path by which power from the coal strip plant in eastern Montana reaches the west coast, Seattle and Portland. And so the reduction in generation that you saw on the previous slide, reduction in coal generation, is due primarily to the additional congestion that would take place on this path with the addition of 6,000 megawatts of wind power. So this gives planners an idea of the effect that could be accomplished by upgrading the path from Montana into Idaho. Next slide, please. Now, among the new scenarios that WEC is modeling includes a new drought scenario, which NREL has been working with WEC to come up with parameters to effectively model this. Now, WEC has always modeled low hydro situations, low hydro scenarios in which you pose the possibility that for some reason you're not going to get as much water from the hydro system as you otherwise would. A drought scenario adds a few more dimensions to this. It assumes that there is a specific reason that you don't have hydro. It's because of drought. When you have drought, you also have higher peak demand. People are running their air conditioners more. Their refrigerators have to run more. But there is just more demand on the system, so use increases, particularly in the Southwest. It also a drought would also have an effect on generation, on thermal generation as well. This scenario would look at more outages at coal, nuclear, and natural gas plants because there would be less water available for cooling. These units would not be able to run as much. Next slide, please. So the results of the early results of WECC's drought scenario modeling show a greater use of combined cycle gas units that are located outside of the drought-prone areas. And they also show less use of, in addition to reduction of hydro, but it also shows less use of steam, of coal and other steam units in Arizona due to greater forest outages. So this is the type of scenario that WECC is modeling. And one of the outcomes that they're looking for from, particularly from drought scenarios, is to make sure that current planning doesn't box the West into a difficult position by planning for a non-drought scenario. If you do have the drought, would that impose changes that you can, that should have been anticipated? So this is the sort of thing that WECC is trying to model. Next slide, please. Okay, so I apologize for going so quickly through this, but I want to stop here and give folks a chance to ask clarifying questions, and I'd like to kind of limit it to clarifying questions so we can get through the remainder of the presentation in time.
Thank you, David. So we did have a question here, and it said basically, is economic upgrades basically the same as merchant transmission market?
No. An economic upgrade can be done either by a utility transmission provider or by a merchant transmission provider. Most projects that are proposed by merchant transmission providers are economic upgrades. I mean, they're looking for some, they're merchants, so they're looking for a profitable deal. Their economic upgrades, their economic projects will have reliability effects that are modeled by the utilities that are involved. But a merchant transmission provider, I mean, the main thing to remember there is that for a long, long time, the transmission business was dominated by regulated utilities. They had a defined service area, and they had sole rights to developing transmission within their service territories. As the system has become more complex, certain incumbent providers have been looking at transmission upgrades in areas that are not their native territory. It's also opened the field for entities that are not regulated monopolies or not regulated entities to build on a merchant basis. But as I said, these are primarily economic upgrades, but that doesn't mean that all economic upgrades are done just by merchant transmission.
Great. Also, people have been asking if these slides will be made available, and they will be made available. We will be sending out a link through an email of where you can access the presentation slides and audio and questions. Since we are a little bit tight with time, let's go ahead and take more questions at the very end of the presentation, and David, you can go ahead and continue.
Okay, so let's go to the next slide. What I want to do is to talk a little bit about some of the operational changes that affect transmission planning. And these are driving not only the transmission projects that are being proposed and studied, but also some of the operations. I want to go into this, number one, because these are issues that are discussed, beyond the electricity sector in general, discussions of renewable energy and how to manage on the system, but also because this may be an aspect of projects that you may be examining that'll be coming across your desk. So let's go to the next slide. Now, variability is one of the main issues that arise with respect to particularly wind power and to an increasing extent solar power as it becomes a larger share of the generation mix. One of the fundamental laws of physics is that electricity cannot be stored economically. It's not like wheat. It's not like corn where you can put it in a silo and take it out whenever you need it. There are storage technologies out there, but they're either too expensive for mass deployment at this point, or there are significant efficiency losses. So for all practical purposes, what is generated at any given moment has to equal the amount of demand at any given moment on the system. And in order to do this, utilities keep reserves, operating reserves on hand to address variations and variations in load. Next slide, please. This shows you a picture of, you know, conceptually what spinning reserves look like. If you think of a gas-fired plant and the amount of electricity it is capable of producing at any given moment, it very seldom will it be running at full capacity. It's going to have some excess on a system that that can be deployed for reserves. And this is what the utility will use to manage the natural variability in load. So if there's a sudden uptick, just for some reason, a lot of people turn on their air conditioners at exactly the same time, that's going to put additional load on the system. There is a signal that the utility can detect to see this. And in response to that sort of a signal, the utility will ramp up the operating reserves on its spinning capacity sufficiently to meet that additional load, so it keeps the system in balance. There are other things that a utility will use in addition: quick start units, units that are actually turned off but can be turned on fairly quickly. And increasingly, there is demand response. Some of the load, some of the demand that is causing changes in demand can also be used in a negative way, in the opposite direction, to be switched off at strategic times, so the demand on the system can be adjusted. Next slide, please. Now, there are different types of variability, and I'm going to go through them quickly here, so we can come back to the ones that are most relevant to the projects you may be looking at. First, there is a seasonal variability. I mean, peak normally occurs, at least in the southern states, in the southern latitudes, peak will occur during the summer when the cooling systems are running at their maximum. This is the peak demand system, and planning takes into account the peak demand during the year. The utility has to make sure it has enough resources on hand and enough transmission to deliver those resources to meet this peak demand, plus an additional reserve margin just to cover the eventuality that there could be a major line loss or a generator loss during the peak season. The shoulder seasons during the spring and the fall are periods of lower demand. These are significant because they indicate when a utility has the flexibility to take units offline for planned maintenance. So these changes, this variability is used from a long-term planning perspective by the utility. Next slide, please. Then there's daily variability. The amount of electricity that is used on a day-to-day basis is different. The smallest demand is early in the morning. The peak demand tends to occur in the middle of the afternoon to late afternoon. And this determines which units that a utility would decide to turn on for the next day, how much those units would be running. It determines how much base load capacity the utility is likely to need throughout the year or during a particular season, how much intermediate and how much peaking capacity. So the daily profile determines the type or the configuration of generation that the utility needs to have on hand ready to go for the next day. Next slide, please. Then there's hourly variability. The daily profile can give you an idea of what predicted load would be at each hour, but you also have to deal with the fact that load will move around. And this is what one of the uses for spinning reserves. You can see here that in this example, you see actual load going slightly higher than what is forecast for the day for the morning from 6 o'clock to 9 o'clock. This is a condition, or this is a situation in which a utility would deploy up reserves. It would ramp up certain units a little bit more to make sure demand and generation were equal. And then it would deploy down reserves when demand would fall below the forecasted amount. Next slide, please. Then there's also short-term or intra-hour variability. This is important from the standpoint of keeping or maintaining the quality of the electrical system. Particularly electronic equipment is calibrated to the frequency of the electrical system. And this is monitored by the utility, and there are certain quick response generators that are automatically dispatched in response to changes in frequency one way or another. This automatic control enables the utility to fine-tune generation so that the quality of the power system is maintained. Next slide. So wind and solar add to variability that is already on the system. And so this is one of the things that WEC and WEC stakeholders are looking at very closely. What are the strategies for mitigating this additional variation? Well, to some extent, the variation can be handled with operating reserves that are already on the system, that the utilities already have. But at some point, the variability is going to go beyond what existing reserves can handle. So the strategies involve how to manage the variability within resources that are already there. The tools for doing that include forecasting, geospatial diversity. Storage, I won't really talk much about here because that's a much longer topic. But storage can sometimes add to the ability to manage variability. We can go to the next slide, please. So what forecasting does is to enable more fine-tuned scheduling day ahead. So if the forecast is suggesting that there will be a lot of wind in the morning but less wind in the late morning, then this enables the utility to adjust the schedule so that it more closely follows what the system is actually likely to need. This reduces the amount of variance. This reduces the amount of reserves that have to be deployed, enabling more wind power, more solar power to be accommodated within the same with the same amount of operating reserves. And what studies have found, what NREL studies have found, large scale analyses, is that the forecasts don't have to be perfect. State-of-the-art forecast is close enough, and that gets you close enough within that area of predictability, so that whatever remaining error is manageable with the existing reserves on the system. Next slide, please. Another area that is being looked at quite a bit is geospatial diversity, and the idea here is that if you have independent processes that are causing some sort of variability, if you split them up and put them in different places, the combined variability is going to be less than what you would see at any of those sites individually. And here we're looking at a couple of sample wind sites taken from the Western Wind and Solar Integration Study that NREL did a couple of years back, looking at Bozeman and looking at Laramie. And these are 10-minute simulated output profiles at these two areas with measurements of the variance, the 10-minute variance in output at these two locations. And what you see here is that when you combine the output of the two areas into one kind of joint managed system, the variance that you have to manage is reduced considerably. It's orders of magnitude less than what you'd have to manage if you were to put all of those resources near Bozeman or near Laramie all by itself. Next slide, please. Managing wider geospatial diversity would require operational mechanisms that do not yet exist. One of the changes that is being investigated right now is something called an energy imbalance market. This is where you expand the scope, the geographic scope of managing the imbalances that take place on a minute-to-minute basis. So, you know, number one, you're netting them out so you have smaller variances, but you've also got a larger pool of reserves to draw from in managing that variability. It's been studied by WEC, it's been studied by the Western Governors Association, but it will likely require some regulatory endorsement from the states. And the idea has encountered some resistance because there are concerns about an EIM leading to a regional transmission organization, which is something that that several states would like to avoid. Next slide, please. Let's see. We'll skip through this. This is detail that y'all can get on the slides later on. Next slide, please. A less formalized approach is control area diversity and reserve sharing. This is basically doing the same thing that an EIM would do, but without a formalized market structure. And this has been tried as a pilot project in the Northwest with some success. So in the absence of an EIM, reserve sharing is one option that utilities are looking at. Next slide, please. So the upshot of all of this planning, not only for planning for specific transmission lines, but for planning how the grid is operated, how the transmission system itself is operated. High penetrations of renewable energy on the grid are feasible, but doing them effectively might require new ways of operating. There are regional planning activities that are going on, and they're looking at major changes that could result in more energy from renewable resources with less capital investment. This is one of the economic drivers that is the focus of production cost modeling and other types of transmission planning. And the aim is to identify a few strategically targeted large transmission projects rather than a proliferation of smaller ones. One 500 kV line can carry as much power across the line as four 230 kV lines. But my guess is that you would much rather prefer reviewing one project and one quarter of land disturbance rather than four. I know most regulators would, because it's fewer rate cases, fewer siting cases, fewer groups of angry landowners coming into their commission meetings. So that's kind of the objective that's behind a lot of these activities that are taking place at WEC. How do we minimize the amount of capital investment but maximize the benefit that we get from that investment? The reforms will likely result in greater weight that is afforded to projects that go through the regional planning process, especially if the project is intended to serve regional markets rather than local load. Local projects, local reliability upgrades can be done with a fairly limited scope of review, a rather specific list of stakeholders. When you get to the larger projects that are more economic in nature, that's when you have a wider array of stakeholders weighing in with respect to need, cost, effectiveness. Is it going in the right place? Should it involve this site or the other site? Next slide, please. So WEC has a portal. And the URL for the portal is here at the bottom. And this This will show the current status for all projects that are currently in the WECC planning process right now. And these include transmission projects and proposals that are not on the earlier map that I showed of the foundational projects. These include those common foundational projects in addition to others that are in the planning process. This is an interactive website. You can, if you have a proposal, if you're reviewing a proposal that involves one of these lines, it's easy to click on that line and get the current information, the current status of that project. So with that, I know we've run a little bit over, but I will stop here and we'll open it up for questions.
Thank you, David. Great presentation. Since we are running tight on time, we'll go ahead and answer one question. And just to let you all know that the questions and answers will be provided along with the presentation slides and the audio at a later date, but I'll be sending out an email to everyone with that link so that you can access the files. But if you do have some questions, please continue to submit by going to the question pane in the box showing on your screen, and we will address those at a later date. So David, I have a question here that how did you measure and predict the congestion that would be passed on to other states?
The congestion that's passed on to other states. Well, there are two ways to do that. One is that if you go back to the example of the Montana stress case, putting 6,000 megawatts of wind power in Montana somewhere. Okay, so the results identified one particular transmission path that would be congested going from Montana into Idaho. So that's congestion that would affect not just Montana, but would actually have more of an impact on Idaho and Oregon and Washington, because that's where the off-takers are. So that congestion would flow down that way. But there are other congestion points on the system. The measure, one convenient measure of the cost of congestion is how LMPs change, how those nodal location specific prices would change, and sometimes, in fact, most often, the changes that you see are not one big spike in an LMP at a given location, but there might be a slightly higher level of LMP that you see across a wider area, and this could be due to just the configuration of the transmission system and how it tries to compensate for transmission for congestion on one point of the line. So it's really the LMPs and the changes, the deltas in the LMPs, that give a measure of how congestion costs will change, not so much by state, but by balancing or by utility service area. Because it's the changes in cost within a utility service territory that will have an effect on the effective price of power at the wholesale level.
Great. Thank you, David. We would like to thank the Bureau of Land Management, David Hurlbut, for their time today. We will, as I mentioned before, we will send out an email to all the webinar participants with the link to the presentation, audio, and questions. And if you have any further questions for the Bureau of Land Management, please contact someone on this slide showing on your screen right now. And this concludes today's webinar. Thank you for participating, and goodbye.